Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature Chef Edward Lee in conversation with Sam Sifton, food editor of the New York Times. This conversation was recorded at the Portland Book Festival in November 2018. The Portland Book Festival 2019 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place on November 9th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. Edward Lee is a chef, restaurant owner, a culinary director, and a writer for documentaries and of books. He joined us on stage to discuss his second book, Buttermilk Graffiti, a chef's journey to discover America's new melting pot cuisine. The book is a road trip travelogue about how the food of different cultures are blending together and influencing each other all around the country. This is a remarkable hour-long conversation about how food, just like language, is always evolving. And in a way, food acts here as a kind of stand-in for all the big cultural questions we face living in a multicultural society. What does it mean to be authentic? What does cultural appropriation really mean? And why does it matter? How can we best move among different cultural communities with respect and acceptance? Food plays a role in our religious, political, personal, artistic, and cultural lives, virtually every aspect of our identities. It is a glue that brings people together every single day. I can think of two no better guides in this moment of our national life than Chef Lee and Sam Sifton.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having us. So I'm Edward Lee. Sam Sifton of the Times Sam. Is with me. No, I'm Sam Sifton, and I'm here with one of America's great restaurateurs and raconteurs and an annoyingly good writer. Whose book, Buttermilk Graffiti, explores, among much else, the concept of the melting pot American cuisine. So I'm going to ask a few questions of him, quite a few questions, and then we're going to do some questions from you at the end, and then the whole reason we're here is to go buy the book and have Edward sign it. We want hand cramps from Mr. Lee from the signing at the end. Edward, this book sets out to tell the story of American food. It's a story that changes weekly, monthly, daily, yearly. And it's a story that took you all over the nation. It's a work of journalism and memoir and a little bit of cookbook too. Can you tell us how it came about?
Like a lot of these ideas form in sort of nebulous places in the back of my head, and they percolate and ferment there for a while and then comes out. So I would say the first time that I thought about doing something like this was when I was on tour for my first book, which was Smoking Pickles. And I'd never really seen, I think if you travel like on tour where you go city after city after city, I think you see the country in a really weird way versus like traveling little bits and pieces at a time. And, you know, I'd like find myself in New Orleans one day and then Seattle another day and Minneapolis and then Denver. And you just sort of crisscross the country. And it just got me to thinking, like, it just, and to backtrack a little bit, like whenever I'm in a city, I always try and do like one fancy meal, right? Like one trendy meal, the stuff that is trending. And then I try to like ask locals and find like that mom and pop store, that place that's serving fried chicken in a gas station somewhere that all the locals know about, but that's generally not written up. And I just kind of do that, like I will juxtapose those two meals. And I find myself thinking like, you know, like that banh mi at the Vietnamese place, was just as good, if not more satisfying, than the place at the Michelin star restaurant, right? Maybe their wine list sucks and their lighting's terrible and the service not so great, but like from a food standpoint, it's really just satisfying. And from a technique standpoint, it's got just as many things in it. It's just we don't write about them as much. And when we do, it's just not written in the same sort of heroic terms that you would like celebrity chefs.
What's interesting is that this book is not a kind of Jane and Michael Stern road food, this is the best banh mi in a gas station in Spokane kind of book. It's really a book about narrative and about the people who are making that banh mi and about story. And I'm interested in what the connection is for you between narrative and food itself.
So to me, when you watch a cooking show and you know they do all the ingredients, right, and there's some good-looking host, and he's like, yeah, and then they eat the bowl.
He only says that because he's one.
I'm not. And they eat the bowl of, you know, the bite of food, right, and they go, that's great. And then it sort of cuts to the next segment. And I always felt like, to me, that magical bite of food was not the end of the segment, it was the beginning of a new segment. And it was like anytime I eat a great dish, I just have these questions that go into my head. I'm like, how did you do this? Where'd you come from? Why did you do this? What's the origin of this? And who's making this food? And why is it so delicious? And when I set out to do this, I thought, you know, I wonder, because when we talk to chefs, right, people who are trained, you know, it's people who are media trained and have gone through all the rigmarole, they have great stories to tell. And I wondered if I go to that fried chicken shack, or if I go to that Nigerian mom and pop store, if I go to that Jewish deli, will I hear stories that are good enough to write about? And not only was I pleasantly surprised, but I was shocked at how deep those stories were and how resonant they were. And that's when I started to really pick up steam and say, I got to write this book.
So one of the interesting things, I'm glad you did write this book.
Thank you.
One of the interesting things that happens in the book is that the food that you are eating comes from a place, but is not perhaps of that place. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a whisper of the word authenticity that kind of hovers over the book in both good ways and bad ways for you. Can you talk about that a little bit, about whether it's a myth or how
yeah,
it plays
so
in?
I always rant against the word authenticity, and I said there's no such thing as so there's two words, there's tradition and there's authenticity. And traditions are things that we create as people, as families, as cultures. And then there's the word authenticity, which to me, on a basic level, is kind of akin to, you know, fascism.
There we
basically
go.
just to you know, keep it light.
Yeah.
It basically is saying, whenever I hear the word authentic, I hear, well, there's only one truth. There's only one way of doing it, and this is the correct way, and everything else is incorrect. And that, to me, just rings pretty hollow when we're talking about food, especially when you think about the history of food. So I always do this, right, because I collect vintage Southern cookbooks, everything from the 1850s all the way up to the present. And I love when someone writes their cookbook and goes, well, these are authentic Southern recipes.
Right.
I love it. Yeah. So then I go, oh, great, like, what does that mean? Like, because I collect Southern cookbooks, and if you're looking at a cookbook in Virginia in the 1850s, it's basically a European cookbook, you know. Then you look at a cookbook, you go a little bit, post-plantation, once African-American cultures were, you know, sort of embedded in the culture, then now you're seeing a lot of African-American recipes in the cookbooks. Then you go to, you know, what I call the Paula Deen era of Southern cookbooks, where everything's deep fried butter, da, da, da. And then you get to this chef era of cookbooks, where it's all very slow, you know, it's very vegetable heavy, it's very creative. All these versions of Southern food are valid, even the Paula Deen one. So whenever someone says to me, this is an authentic Southern cookbook, I go, what you're trying to say is this is true to a certain era or a certain time that is of, you know, what is traditional to me.
Right.
Right.
It's authentic to oneself, right, or to one's experience.
But the word authentic to me rings like, well, and the reason someone says authentic to me, it connotates by saying this is an authentic cookbook, you're saying the other ones are inauthentic.
Got it.
Right? The other ones don't count, because mine are truly authentic. And that's, it just, I've never found one cookbook to be the authentic version of anything.
So if authenticity is fascism.
Yes.
Then what
is.
In
its worst form.
Then what is cultural appropriation?
Cultural appropriation is, we're all guilty of it. It's our.
It's humankind.
It's human nature.
It's culture itself.
It's culture itself, yeah. And this is something that as you know, I've been, because one of the things I do in this book is, right, I go to a Nigerian neighborhood or a Cambodian neighborhood, and I culturally appropriate all that I can and sort of come up with my own recipes at the end of each chapter. And you know, part of it is, if you do it out of a place of respect, if you give credit where credit is due, if you are truly trying to expand the conversation, it's okay. Not only is it okay, it's what we ought to be doing. Like, what's the opposite of cultural appropriation is, well, you can only cook the food of your own culture, of your own race, of your own ethnicity. And I don't know anything that's more racist than that, to say that, oh, you're Chinese, you can only cook Chinese food, right? And to me, that doesn't work either.
There's also, I get the sense from the book, there's a way in which America itself appropriates as a culture, insofar as there's no way you couldn't, even if you rejected the notion of authenticity as a fascistic term, if you wanted to cook authentic Cambodian food,
you
couldn't do it. No. It's so literally impossible.
When my family, we came from Korea in the early 70s, and when we came over, I don't know, my parents had this idea that they didn't want to live in the Korean neighborhood, so we lived in the sort of Pakistani and Jamaican neighborhood, and just brilliant of them. I grew up with pork, you know, beef patties, like that was my lunch every day. So she had to go, there was no Korean, you know, she wanted to make kimchi, right, using the red chili flakes, but none of the sort of Italian or Polish stores had the right chili flakes. So she had to go to the Jamaican store to get the correct chili flakes to use in her kimchi, in her Korean kimchi. Now, it's a small substitution, but in that, you're already kind of tinkering
right.
with the thing.
They begin to mount.
They begin to mount, and my parents didn't, but some people were like, oh my God, what's that goat? You know, maybe I'll try that next time because it's really cheap and it's on sale. So I always tell my mother, I go like, Mom, you were the first fusion chef. And she really doesn't like that. But that's what we did, right? Immigrants came here and you couldn't find what ingredients you needed, so you improvised. But to me, my theory anyway, is that through that improvisation, we came up with this really cool thing called American food. And American cuisine is anything that we try and do in this country that we try to replicate back home, but quite can't do it, so we substitute and we do this and we have conversations and we start talking to our Indian neighbors and we start mixing curries into things that didn't belong, and we just make this big pot of mess.
And if we do it well, and it doesn't look like a big pot of mess, but looks like a beautiful plate of food, we may become successful restaurateurs, as you have done. Now, it's my contention that food, that restaurants, are a form of culture no different from painting or dance or books or music. I've had push and pull with you and other chefs about whether that's the case for food. Do you think there's an argument to be made for cuisine as artistry?
I do, but not all chefs and not all food. I don't think of myself as one, but you know, like there's the Beatles, you know, and then there's like people who write jingles, right? And they're both music. Right, but there are, and just like in food, I mean, there's everything from Taco Bell to people in Switzerland doing some really incredible stuff. But I do think culturally, we've gotten to a point where food matters. Food matters on a political level. It matters it's culturally influencing people. It matters how chefs are sort of changing how we look at the world. It definitely is, you know, changing culture.
Well, we'll stick with the Beatles for a minute because I think one of the interesting things that has happened with food over the course of the last 30 years is that it's moved away from being what it was traditionally. For the restaurant kitchen was a blue-collar place. It was hard, anonymous, difficult work. And now we're rocking out with our stringed instruments at the UCC. So you're a rock star, but once you would have been just the anonymous guy behind the kitchen door. One of the cool things about this book is how you, I think I got a quote from memory, but you address the kind of love and care that you identify in this anonymous or so-called anonymously made food, and you return to that again and again in your storytelling. When did you grok that, to use the tech term?
There's something about watching someone do a craft, and they do it again and again and again. And but I'm constantly always like looking to do things. My life is always spinning with different things. And when you interview someone, you look at someone who does the same thing for 10 years, 20 years. There's a woman that runs a soul food restaurant in Alabama. She's been doing it for 34 years. And just you kind of sit there and you just process that for a second. 34 years of toiling away in a kitchen. There's something else motivating her. This is not money.
Yep.
Right? It's not money. It's not fame. She's not famous. What is it then? And that question, if you start, and it's like watching a miso maker in Japan or someone in Mexico making tortillas by hand every day. There's something that motivates them, and that to me is the ultimate underlying question of like what motivates people to do these things. And it's actually kind of no different than my father-in-law was a carpenter, and no relation to food, but he made this beautiful sort of handmade carpentry, and he did it for like 40 years, and just went to work every day anonymously, and just like would shave these beautiful chairs, and to me that's something that I wish I had, or I wish I had more of, and to me that's true craft. There's a true craft in that. I don't know if that's art, but
right.
It's craft.
The artist yearns to be a craftsman sometimes. One of the great things about the book is that you write often as a pure observer, a kind of de Tocqueville of the kitchens across of America.
Oh, I like that. I like that.
You like that?
I like that. I like that.
We're gonna blurb that in the paperback. The de Tocqueville of the kitchens. But that role leads you occasionally to question what it is you're doing, whether you're observing or whether you're stealing souls. Like, what are you intruding in some way? Are you changing the narrative by being there? Can you talk a little bit about that tension as you travel?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of... one of the fascinating chapters to me. So I go to Michigan, Dearborn, Michigan, which is the home of the largest Muslim population in America.
And when did you go?
I went during Ramadan, which I don't know if that's their holy week, so they don't eat.
Swing and a miss.
It's not the hottest time to go to Dearborn, Michigan.
Not for food.
Not for food. But it was also right after the Orlando nightclub shooting, which is a couple of years ago, where a someone that was reportedly Muslim shot up a gay nightclub, and so it was a very tense time. And so here I walk in to a spiritual week, very tense, and Al Jazeera is playing on all the TVs, and that no one's talking, and of course I look like a reporter, right? I got a pen and pad, and I'm just asking questions, and they're like, "We're not talking to you. Like, it's not." And I got it. I was like, "Yeah, this is going to be a waste of a trip." And I was anyway. It's in the book, but something happens, and I go, "Well, I'm going to fast for Ramadan." And to me, it wasn't necessarily. I don't know. I wasn't doing it as a gimmick. It was kind of a way for me to try to get into the culture, but through a form of respect. And I didn't know if anything was going to come out of it. But I was like, yeah, I got nothing else to do. I may just try it. So I go and I walk into a restaurant and I order all this food. And, you know, I take notes and I take pictures, and I asked the lady, I said, can you box it up for me? And she says, you didn't eat anything. And I said, no, because I'm doing Ramadan. And she looked at me and she goes, you're not Muslim. I go, no, I'm not Muslim, but I'm writing a story about food. And to me, I feel like the only way to understand your food is through your religion. And like in that moment, when she realized that I wasn't there to necessarily intrude, but I was there to really just learn. And what I found again and again and again in these cultural things is like, there's a lot of suspicion, right? There's a lot, I mean, they've probably been, you know, burned once or twice. And so there's a lot of suspicion. So the minute she realized that I wasn't really there to harm her, she was like, oh, well, if you want, you got to talk to my husband. And then the husband was like, oh, well, you got to talk to some guy at the mosque and you got to go over there. And next thing you know, I was being introduced to all these people in the community who were taking me along because they wanted to show me the correct way for things. And that little act, that little gesture, if it were, just changed everything. And so that changed the way I approached culture. And I don't know, in some ways to this day, it changes how I just approach cultures in general, right? Like we walk into some place and I just go, okay, so we're walking into a Cuban restaurant, like, this is their space, right? Because to me, the immigrant restaurant is very different from like when I open a restaurant, right? I open a restaurant, you guys are free to come in and complain about the food and yell at my servers and tell me my food sucks and, you know, the fish is overcooked. And it's just, it's valid, right? And you complain about the lighting and all the other things. But immigrant restaurants are different, right?
Good description.
It's pretty accurate. They're places not necessarily just for food. They're places of where communities gather, right? It's kind of their safe space. It's their place where they know they can gather and they talk about things and they talk about the communities and they like trade business cards for accountants and all these things, right? It really like community happens there. So all of a sudden I walk in there and I'm not walking into a restaurant like the way I think of a restaurant.
Right.
I'm walking really into their living room. And so it's just a different form of, I don't know, humility almost. Which is weird to think that when you walk into someone else's restaurant that you're spending money at, you should be humble. But I learned that through
right.
Through
and
this.
you learned that as a journalist. And I think that the story that you just told sort of illustrates one of the learning steps that you take on the way to becoming a better reporter. And I'm not really into spoilers in books, but to me, in this chapter that you're talking about, the key moment is not that you learn to be humble, because of course that just makes you a better reporter, a better person, but that first taste of mint tea that you have after this long fast and the intensity, I don't want to take the words out of your mouth, but the intensity of the mint flavor as if you had never tasted it before.
And it was funny, right? Because the ritual is like, so I go and I order all this food and I'm telling the guy, I'm like, I'm fasting, I haven't eaten in 12 hours and boy, am I hungry. And you know, and I just got a swift sort of backhand lesson and like, no, the whole point of Ramadan is not, you know, to gorge after, but it's about empathy and human suffering and all this. And here's the, at the end of the chapter, I know nothing more about the Muslim religion than I did, you know, 4 days ago. But what I experienced was a human experience. I don't know if it was a religious experience, but it was a human experience. And it was something shared. And I don't know anything more about the Muslim religion, but I do know a lot more about the people that live in Dearborn, Michigan. And I don't know if that's a connection that I don't know if I was able to put that through in the book, but that's part of, you know, and to flip it into a bigger discussion, like, I wish we did that more with people, right? And instead of making it about a religion or a sex or a race or a thing, it's all about people. And if you could make that, you know, I know tons of people, because I live in Kentucky, God bless Kentucky, but I live in Kentucky, where people go, why, you know, you can't walk into a room full of, you know, Muslim people and this and this and that, and there's all these preconceived notions. When you just go, actually, they're people first, the religion comes second.
So let's talk about that for a minute. We'll switch directions. I don't want to leave these good people here with the mistaken impression that you're just a good writer. You're also, of course, a wildly successful restaurateur, television guy, filmmaker, purveyor of hot sauce. You got all kinds of stuff going on. And above all, in some quarters, you're a committed advocate for social justice. And I'd like to ask you about that last bit now as a Kentuckian. and about how that role intersects with the job of being a restaurateur.
Yeah. So I've always believed in this, right? Sort of one of the tenets of being a restaurant owner is that everyone's welcome, and you keep your politics out of the restaurant, and you keep your own political views out of commerce, right? Because ultimately, what I do is commerce. I have a product, I sell it, you pay me, you leave happy. And I guess that changed sometime in the last couple of years. And it's not a Trump thing. It happened before, and I think it changed because when I realized that I have something of a platform to talk and to talk to people, and for one reason or another, you guys are here to listen to me, that there was something that, you know, at the end of the day, I'm just serving food. But I do think that the power of the dinner table, the power of people convening together over food, it has a bigger message than just, man, wasn't that foie gras amazing? Which is still a cool message. but there's something deeper beyond that. And I do feel like in the last couple of years, I feel like chefs, especially if you have a platform, especially if you have an audience, you bear a little bit of responsibility to make the world a little better place.
Well, so here's the thing. That message plays beautifully for us who are experiencing the foie gras, but also the sort of sense that the chef behind it is doing good in the world. But one of the things our reporting has taught us over the course of the last year or so is that the restaurant world can be kind of a dark and loathsome place as well, particularly for women. And we saw some top restaurateurs in the last year, Mario Batali, Ken Friedman, and others, toppled because of their behavior, not so much with those of us who go to restaurants as guests, but to the women who work there. And I think we're pretty clearly dancing around the notion of a reckoning point. And I wonder if you could tell us why you think this issue has been so fraught and longstanding for the food world.
So I have a lot of things to say about that, which probably is not, you know, for this discussion necessarily. But one of the things because I get this question a lot, and we talk about it a lot, I don't know if it's a food world problem. I think it's a man's problem. And I think it's thank you. I think you see it in every industry where you have men in power, or not, where you have an inequality of gender in power. And you see it again and again and again, and it's not gonna go away until we fix that. And that's where I sort of go, I can't fix the world's problems.
Yeah, but you started the Lee Foundation to try and address it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So one of the things we did was we founded a nonprofit last year, and the simple goal was to put more women in positions of power in the food industry. So it's a thank you. And I really, to be 100% honest, there's a woman that runs the foundation. I just help her out. This is just because, you know, I don't want to take credit for it, everything. But she does a great job, and it was really her idea. And here's my thing, right? There's policy, and then there's reality, right? And the policy is you can't bully someone at work. You can't grab someone's ass. You can't sexually harass someone, right? That policy has been in place forever. The reality is different. And until there's a woman... You know, so at 610, we have a...
At 610 Magnolia, the restaurant in Louisville.
There's a woman that's been the GM there for years. And I just don't worry about it. Not because my other restaurants don't have the same policy. It's because she has zero tolerance for it. Because she's in charge. So if something happens, if it was a male GM, he would go, listen, guys, just don't do that, please. You know, and she goes, nope, you're out. Right? And that's just, and I go, fine, you just fired a really good waiter, but if that's your call, that's your call. Right? So it's just, I don't want to simplify the whole issue because it's very complex. But when you have someone in power who has zero tolerance for that stuff, it just doesn't happen. And so where I see in the kitchen, which is funny, right? I have three restaurants in Louisville. All three are run by women, GMs. I have three kitchens in Louisville. All three are run by men, right? So it's just, you just don't have that in there. So one of the things that we did was a culinary program where we go, listen, we need more women head chefs. We need more women owners. We need more women investors, right? Because it's also, it's a fight. The restaurant business is a financial, at the end of the day, after everything, it's a financial institution, right? If you can have a restaurant run by all men, if you had a female investor who said, I'm not going to take that, or I'm pulling my money out, guess what? Everyone's going to come in line real fast. So we need more women investors. We need more women in the higher up, you know. And I do believe, listen, even as a man, like, I just, it's not that I want, you know, men or women, I just want equality. Anytime you have more equality, more diversity in any industry, it gets better. And that's what kind of what we're fighting for. So,
which is a good message.
Yeah.
Now we're going to do something that I love to do and my friend Eduardo hates to do, which is to play a little speed round,
because
we got a little deep there, and now we got to go high. So
I was very bad at this.
No, you're going to be great at it. We're on a road trip. It's just the two of us. We're like in a pickup truck, an F-150.
Okay.
We're on the highway. We're almost out of gas. We pull into a Quickie Mart. I'm getting gas. You're getting snacks. What are those snacks?
Slim Jims, combos, and Cool Ranch Doritos.
You did it. Okay.
And a Red Bull. Sorry.
And Red Bull. Listen, Red Bull fuels the restaurant industry on both sides. Like, for me, it's that pure taste of cancer that... I love a Red Bull. Where and when are you at your happiest? Don't think.
In my room, in my attic late at night, when everyone's asleep and no one's bothering me and I'm just working on stuff.
It's a finished attic?
Yeah.
It's not like a creepy attic?
No, it's... But it's a mess, and like
it can be a mess.
The housekeeper's not in, like it's hands off. It's like my mess of an attic. It's the best place in the world.
Okay, I just opened your fridge. What am I seeing?
Lots of condiments and nothing else.
That's pretty good. What go to condiments? What's the mayonnaise in there?
Dukes. It's always Dukes.
Is the man of the South.
Yeah. Dukes, like four different kinds of mustards, like six different kinds of hot sauces. Yeah. Then everything else, I just eat leftovers from the restaurant. Like, I bring over leftover stuff from the restaurant, and then I put
condiments on it.
That's most of the glamorous life I lead.
Yeah.
It's like cold food with lots of condiments.
The chef life, ladies and gentlemen. All right, back to the serious stuff. What is the single most important issue, food issue, facing those of us, or just any issue that face those of us who love food in America today?
I think we all take it for granted that this whole food, like cool food revolution, this whole thing, whether it's organic food or local sustainable food, that all of this, all the things that we've gained in the last 20 years are here to stay. And I think any time that we take things for granted, they go away. And the restaurant industry, I think most of us have to remember, and as someone who's followed the food world for a long, long time, I have to remember, like, 25 years ago, the food outside of the big cities in America sucked.
That's putting it mildly.
Yeah. 35 years ago, the food sucked everywhere, and it wasn't just that it sucked. It was only for the very rich.
Yeah.
It was the food system was terrible. It was most of what you were eating was processed. It was shipped in from miles away from factory farms and all over the globe. We didn't have the food system that we do now, this distribution, farmers markets, all of that. This is in the last 20, 25 years, and we've come to take it for granted, and we think because we enjoy it with our latte on Sunday mornings that it's always going to be here. And I'm here to tell, as someone who studies and looks at it, it's not. It's all tinkering on a very few things, whether it's policy, commerce, economics, that could all go away very easily, as very quickly as it came. And so, you know, as consumers, you have to support. I know it's hard because everyone, you know, everyone thinks that chefs are wealthy and they make a lot of money. And the food system, it needs your support in ways beyond even just a dollar. You know, the things that we, you know, and a lot of it starts with just educating yourself, knowing where you're spending that dollar, you know, because you're going to spend X amount of dollars every week on food. And how you choose to spend that money is really important. It's really important.
But it's also terrifying because we live now in a world in which we're at a high water mark for great restaurants and great food distribution for those who can afford a $7 latte. And for those who can't, it's a $1 hamburger. Mm-hmm. And that dichotomy is not sustainable.
It's not. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, I don't have all the answers, but I do think cooking, like actually just cooking at home, with your own ingredients, like, you know, and as a chef, I hate to say this, but like...
No, I love it. Keep going.
You know, it's, I always tell this to my cooks, and it's funny, because I got a whole bunch of cooks that work for me, and I go, you guys realize you don't know how to cook. And they're like baffled. They're like, what are you talking about? We did 400 covers, man. And I go, you guys don't cook. Cooking is done at home. That's cooking. What we do at restaurants is a very, very complex and a beautiful ballet, but it's a really highly organized assembly line. So when you walk into a restaurant and you order a plate of food and you got chicken, sauce, vegetables, so one person got the chicken, butchered it, and gave it to another person who cooked it. Someone tourneed the vegetables and gave it to another person who roasted it. Someone spent all day working the sauce, all combined. There's not one person that saw that plate through from beginning to end. That's not cooking. That's an assembly line. Cooking is when you wake up in the morning, you get out a recipe, and you go to a store, and they don't have the Brussels sprouts, so you get the cabbage instead, and you do this, and you come home, you realize you forgot the butter, so you do this, and then you call up your friend, you're like, hey, can I get some butter? I'm sorry, I owe you money, but... And you make this food, and you cook it, and you eat it, and you wash the dishes, and at the end of the day, you're exhausted. That's cooking. And that's, you know...
So... www.nytcooking.com.
And that's a good.
Thank you for that plug, Edward Lee. Okay, so back to the book for a moment, and I don't want to dominate, although I like dominating this conversation. We're going to take some questions from you in a sec. I've just got a few more for Ed before we get to them. So the title of the book, and I can kind of, I'll kind of give the background, but because I want to. Twisted at the end. So it's called Buttermilk Graffiti, but it takes him from like kind of a graffiti fan youth in New York to the sort of buttermilk drenched life in Kentucky that he leads now. So Buttermilk Graffiti. And what's interesting to me is there's not much Brooklyn in this book.
No.
And I'm interested in inquiring why that is. One of the great immigrant cities of the United States.
Oh, so, and as far as locale?
Yes.
So, one of the things I did, I purposely, with a few exceptions, I stayed away from New York, Chicago, LA, you know, the big beds of immigration. And the reason is this. When my parents came over in the early 70s, there weren't a lot of Koreans, right? So when they came over, like, if you wanted to survive and live in New York, you had to deal with the Jewish locksmith and the Jamaican, you know, chili seller and the Pakistani guy that would fix your car. Like, you had to venture outside of the comfort zone of your own ethnic group just to get things done,
yep.
Right? And through that, you had cultural interaction, some good, some bad, but you had to sort of function outside of that. What's happened in especially in New York, but other places like Chicago too or Atlanta, you have fully embedded, you know, ethnic enclaves where now you can be a Korean person, come to Flushing, Queens, and never have to interact with someone outside of your race to get anything done. You can go to school in Korea, you can get a real estate agent, taxes, everything. So what makes it a really interesting tourism kind of from a tourist standpoint, it makes it really interesting. You go to a Peruvian neighborhood, Korean neighborhood, but for someone like me that was trying to write this book, it wasn't very interesting because there was no cultural clash anymore. What I found, so I write about a Korean restaurant in Alabama. Now that's interesting. Because those now have to deal with the people in Alabama, and that, to me, that's interesting. When all of a sudden you have to culturally figure out how to unite or not, or somehow work with the cultures around you, and especially when there's older cultures that are, you know, maybe there's some tension involved. To me, that's exciting. And so when I did write about Brooklyn, I wrote about Little Russia or Little Odessa, where and this is the Brooklyn of my youth, right? Where it was Italian and Polish were just sort of moving out, and the Jamaicans and Pakistanis and the Indians were moving in, and now it's Russian, and now it's Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. So that progression, that kind of constant thing, and you know, everyone says, I come from Brooklyn, right? And I was like, oh man, that's cool. I'm like, no, you don't understand. Canarsie is not. Yeah. Canarsie is the armpit of Brooklyn, and it always will be. But it's like, it's this beautiful place where all immigrants come to struggle and scrape and claw and cry and just work their way up. And as soon as you get out, you do not look back. You just run until the next immigrant crew comes in and they do the same thing. And to me, that's the American identity, right? You come here, and we're seeing it now play out, not necessarily in places like Canarsie, but in places like Raleigh-Durham, in Louisville, in Alabama, places where you normally wouldn't think of as diverse. But why not? There's jobs, it's cheap, decent living, there's plenty of land.
So one of the things, and I swear, I'm getting to you guys, promise, you know, what goes around comes around. You devised this book out of the kind of traveling around the nation for Smoking Pickles. So if you've been traveling around the nation yet again on this book, and if I'm not saying you should do, you know, Buttermilk Graffiti 2, the remix, but have you come across communities now that interest you for the same reason?
Yeah.
And what are
they? The interesting thing about writing this book is that, A, when I was writing the book and telling people about it, every single person I ran into had their own suggestion of where I should go.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning they all knew of they're like, oh my God, you got to come to Durham because there's Portuguese people who have set up this. And they're like, so I may have notes and notes. And B, now that the book's come out, I get plenty of emails from people who are saying, man, you should come to Wisconsin and see the Basque culture in Wisconsin. I'm like, never even knew that. And so it just affirms what I truly believe in, like these little pockets of culture are everywhere, you know. And what fascinated, one of the stories that fascinates me the most are for example, there's a group of Somalis that have set up in Maine.
Yes, Lewiston, Maine.
Of all places. Climate-wise, could not be...
No, could not be worse.
Worse.
Although it's a good climate for raising goat, and they do well with the goat, the Somali community there. So the way this is going to work, I think there are two mics. I think there's one up top, and there's one down here. And so you're going to raise your hands, and this is complicated, but we're in school and can manage this. I'm going to pick two people, and we'll go to one, and then we'll go to the other, and then we'll do it again. And that way we won't be running around as much. I'm a good teacher.
Or you can all leave.
Or you can just walk out.
I'm sorry, I'm joking.
Okay, we've got one here.
You talked about 25 years ago, there wasn't very much diversity in foods. 25 years ago, we used to have home economics teaching kids how to cook. That's gone now from schools. Any thoughts on that?
That 25 years ago, there were home ec cooks.
In school,
I wish, I listen, if they had home ec in my school, I'd have been all over that. I don't know what they teach in schools these days.
Yeah.
I don't know what they do in schools. And not even to be a chef or just the basic skills of how to, cook. Is just such a basic skill. I think it should be taught in every school and from early. I did. My daughter goes to kindergarten now. She's 5 and a half. And I volunteered and I said, I want to teach them all how to make dumplings. And they were like, eh. And I went there and man, they all loved it. They all loved it. And they all, you know, it was, you got to start young, you know, with that stuff.
I don't mean to keep shilling for what I do, but it's
www.ny.
I got him doing it. I got, yeah. But seriously, cooking now at home is on the rise again. And it may be on the rise again because our economy is going to be in trouble and we're all going to be broke and we have to cook at home. But we are seeing that rise, and I'm here to help you. We got one right in the, thank you. We got one right in the middle here and then right in the middle on the other side.
Thank you. The first thing I want to say is there is actually a culinary school for inner city young people here in Portland
called
Poshines.
What's it called?
Poshines Culinary School. So it's a great project. You should have a look at it. The second thing is I'm originally from Birmingham, Alabama, and I kind of recognize this regional food culture, but it sounds like you're describing more of a micro-regional food culture that's going on in the country. Could you just say a little bit about like what you found traveling around, kind of what that looks like, because it seems like we're moving away from regional cuisine into smaller areas.
The funny thing about the micro, right, is that regional is like, I'll take Alabama as an example, right? Regional is like, it's in the South, you know, historically, plantations, agriculture, corn, right? And all of that is sort of regional, environmental, right? And sort of cuisine comes out of that. And a lot of what I write about in the book is immigrants, and one of the biggest things that's happened, you know, is planes, trains, and automobiles, right? So an immigrant population, or like literally one family, can like drop down in Alabama and go, oh, this is nice, and they call their friends and they go, you should come here. And they come and they call their cousins and go, yeah, come. And all of a sudden, you get this thing that pops up out of nowhere, and in many ways, it has no relation to history, agriculture, anything. And then they start going, well, I can't get lemongrass here. I can't get ginger here. I can't get, curry leaves. But the climate's good. It's kind of like back home in India. Let's start growing it in our garden. Or let's go buy this cheap plot of land behind this, you know, auto mechanic, and let's start growing. And you see these, and it's amazing what they can do with, like, a half an acre of garden, and a couple of resourceful people. Like there's farmers markets in Louisiana that I've been to, like the Vietnamese neighborhoods. And it's like, you think you're in Vietnam, you know? I mean, it is the variety of stuff, and it's not just Thai basil, it's like 16 versions of basil, you know? None of which I was familiar with. And these things just pop up out of nowhere, and it's an amazing thing to see. And then what happens is the local chefs get wind of that. Right, and you know, your food gets better because they're like, I don't have to go to Kroger to buy my ginger. Now I'm getting it straight from the Vietnamese farmer over here. And then that microculture starts to seep into the regional culture, and then it all starts to blend up. And that's American food.
That's the story of America. Yeah. I think we had one right in the middle there.
When I was a kid, we'd go to the butcher, and the nose of the pig was over here, and it went all the way through the pig to the tail. You just don't see that anymore. What do you think, as a chef, is what is our obligation to eat all the parts of the animal if we're going to eat animals, rather than just the choice a little bit?
Well, I would even take it one step further than that and stop eating the animals that you're really familiar with, right? Start eating animals that you are unfamiliar with, because the restaurant world has caught wind of the nose to tail thing, so like we're buying up all the pieces that you don't use. But like, you know, we need to eat more rabbits, goats, guinea hens, you know, capon, like you know, pheasants, squab, like all the. There's such a diversity of animals that we can eat. And we eat chicken, beef, and pork, you know, and I think that's one of the things that really harms the food system, is that when you do have monocultures of farms, and if we just, like, goats are the most nutritious, they're easy to grow, they're great, you know, and you just don't see them on menu. It's also the most popular meat globally, but in this country, we don't eat as much goat.
Right up top, why don't you take us home?
So 25 years from now,
yeah.
How would, what do you predict, or how do you predict that people will eat, go out to eat, prepare food at home other than having
25 years from now, I'm going to be smoking weed on an island and not worrying about any of this. No, you, I couldn't care less. No, I'm. I don't know. 20. You answer that. You're a better indicator of.
I'm going to be on the next boat to the island. We got to see. I hope more people will be cooking at home, and I hope that the people who go to restaurants will be having a good time and paying the employees of those restaurants a fair and living wage.
Very nice. Thank you.
Thank you very
much.
Thank
you, guys.
That was Chef Edward Lee in conversation with Sam Sifton at the Portland Book Festival in November 2018. The Portland Book Festival 2019 lineup has just been announced. The festival will take place on November 9th in downtown Portland. For more information about the author lineup, schedule, and tickets, visit literary-arts.org. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from The Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for The Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of The Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.